Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Mono Cases. True story, I have a parts caster that is very, very close to my heart. I built it myself, which means a ton to me. It has some pieces on it that have a lot of meaning for me, and I looked high and low for a case that would fit it well. I bought a cheap one on Amazon. That one was a dud. It just sits in my closet gathering dust. But I eventually picked up a Mono Vertigo electric guitar case, and you know what? I love it. It's lightweight. It fits my back perfectly. It has a great pocket that fits my MacBook Air just right and securely, and it is built to last. Thank you to Mono for sponsoring this podcast, as well as so many other Fretboard Journal initiatives. You can go over to monocreators.com to see their entire line of not only cases, but pedal boards and a lot more. Again, go to monocreators.com. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Today's podcast is a bit of a surprise for me. I didn't know this was going to be a podcast, but I had such a great chat with mandolinist Andy Statman that I thought I would make it an episode. Andy and I talked. We did an article on his new record, Monroe Bus, on fretboardjournal.com. You can check that out, but if you're already listening to this podcast, you get way more than just what was on that online piece. Because Andy and I talked about all sorts of stuff, learning from Dave Terrace, his family. He came from a family of singers. Learning from Bill Monroe, following Bill Monroe around, learning from Grisman, taking lessons from David Grisman. This was such a cool interview. Andy is one of my favorite musicians, and Monroe Bus is definitely one of my favorite records of 2019, so I encourage you all to check it out. I hope you enjoy it. In other big news, in other big Fretboard Journal mandolin news, Fretboard Journal 44 is mailing to everyone, and Mandolin Orange is in that issue. Spoiler alert. Along with a lot more, we cover the restoration of Speedy West's Bigsby guitar in that issue. We do an article on the history of neck resets and a lot more. If you don't have a subscription yet, now is the time to do it, because for the next week, we're going to be giving you, sending you Fretboard Journal 44 at no extra cost. We can start you off with that one. So go to fretboardjournal.com to subscribe. You can also now get a digital subscription by going into our shop tab and then clicking on downloads. You will see it. And so no matter where you are in the world, it's one low price for the PDF version. And I hope that you will subscribe, because we are a reader-supported magazine, and that's really what powers all the stuff we do, the videos, the podcasts, all the cool online content. What else can I tell you? I'm about to head over to Nazareth, Pennsylvania to go visit Martin Guitars. So be on the lookout on our Instagram as well as our Facebook for photos and videos from that road trip. It's going to be a fun one. And the 11th episode of The Truth About Vintage Amps just got posted, the podcast I co-host with Skip Simmons. And that is quickly becoming, I guess you'd call it, a runaway hit. I had no idea how many of you would be obsessed over learning about other people's amp woes and how to fix them. Skip is an entertaining host. It's such an informative show. Give it a try if you haven't yet. Even if you don't think you care at all about electric guitars or amplifiers, it is a lot of fun. I would encourage you to start with episode one, though, because there is sort of a linear narrative here, and you're going to miss out on some inside jokes if you started with episode 10 or 11. All right, without further ado, here is my talk with Andy Statman. I hope you enjoy this interview. I had a blast talking to him. Andy was in one of the first issues of the Fretboard Journal. I think Fretboard Journal 3 is probably due to be in the Fretboard Journal again very soon. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoy our chat.
Yeah, this is Andy.
It's Jason from the Fretboard Journal.
Scott, thanks for calling.
Of course. Thanks for talking to us. Are you sick of talking about this record yet?
No. You know, it's not really, no.
All right. Well, congratulations. It's amazing.
Good question. Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much. I'm great to enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I don't ask all the same questions everybody else did, but I probably will. You know, we've talked to you a bunch over the years. You were in our second issue. Thank you for doing that. This record is amazing. It's not really a tribute record to Bill Monroe, though. It's right. I mean, that would be misleading.
Well, you know, he had a lot. You know, he had, no, it's if I did a tribute to him specifically, I'd probably play his tunes. I mean, this is more of a tribute to the spirit of what he did. You know, in some ways. But in that tribute, I would say not really, no. I mean, it started out as being, and I never even thought of it as a tribute, just as, doing a record of, improvisations on Bill Monroe tunes. And I just wound up writing my own tunes. So that's sort of where it went. But, you know, Bill Monroe was, he's a big influence in my playing, particularly the way I use my right hand and my understanding of tone production. And Monroe is definitely sort of always there hovering in the background, with a bunch of others as well.
Well, we talk to me a little bit about that right hand thing and how what sticks with you from Monroe, listening to Monroe and your times with Monroe and kind of how that has affected your playing even now.
Well, back when I was just going, when I was learning how to play bluegrass, I mean, I studied, Monroe, Jesse, Bobby Osborne. I sort of trained my wrist to be able to sound like them, to emulate their tone. So it's really an understanding of tone, but the way Monroe uses his right hand to play, to play notes, to play tremolo, to play, to play rhythm, there's a very specific sound that has a real sort of intensity to it that I always liked. Not that the others don't have intensity, and they've developed different tones that are more suitable to their style, but I found in Bill Monroe's style something that was a bit more universal that I could apply to a lot of other things. His right hand is always going for feeling. And expressing his musical ideas, it's always expressing feeling, a depth of feeling. And, I was and still am very drawn to that approach.
There are thousands of mandolin players who have bought an F5 or F5-style mandolin to try to capture that tone. You've played those mandolins. You've also obviously famously played the A-style. Is it all in the hands, really? Or have you adapted your style to kind of evoke what you were hearing, or how does that, what's the balance there?
I've played like an F5, style mandolin for the last probably 10 years. It's just that it was all, to me, it was a matter of the neck rather than the sound. I mean, I could play like Bill Monroe on the A2Z I had, and people wouldn't know it was it's an oval hole mandolin. It's really the right hand. It's really understanding how to use the right hand to produce a certain tone.
Got it. Where do most beginning mandolin players mess up, for lack of a better word?
Well, I mean, there's lots of different schools of mandolin playing, so it really depends what style of music you want to play, and the main thing is to emulate the people whose playing you like. You want to be able to not only play with the left hand the way they play, and the left hand is really the right hand is really a much bigger deal than the left hand. You really need to start to understand what tone is and how tone expresses feelings and ideas. And you really need to emulate the tone of the people who you want to sound like, rather than just, playing the notes they're playing. You really need to understand how to produce their tone to get that sound and that feeling that's drawing you in.
Yeah.
Because it's really ultimately very much about sound and how you use sound as opposed to just musical ideas. The tone is a very big musical idea and really expresses a lot. That's why, we might like certain singers who just have incredible voices, even might be styles that we we're not familiar with, but the sound of their voice is great, or, you know, clarinet players, or saxophone players, or trumpet players. It's really, or violinists for that matter, it really has, you know, all to do with the tone. And like in any style, just as you want to learn the language, the musical language of the style, learning the tonal language of the style in terms of tone production is equally important. And once you can do that, and maybe, you know, you begin to use it on your own. So I had a number of different models in bluegrass whose tone I was able to emulate when I played in their styles. And I understand how their musical choices, their melodic, you know, their note choices, really fit in perfectly with the tone that they were looking for. And, you know, each person is an individual, but particularly when you go back to the, you know, the founders of bluegrass mandolin, which would be, you know, Bill Monroe and Jesse McReynolds and Bobby Osborne, and then, you know, the people after them like Herschel Sizemore and Frank Wakefield, John Duffy, they all sort of developed their own understanding of tone based on, I guess, what they were feeling and what sounded good, you know, with the style that they were playing. Maybe each had a bit of a different tone conception. You know, Bobby initially came out of, you know, the Bill Monroe thing, but developed his own, you know, wonderful, unique style. So it's, you know, tone is all the right hand. It's like, it's like the voice box, you know, for a singer, or it's like, you know, for a woodwind player, it's the embouchure. It's really, you know, the tone is really it. That's what you really need. And, you know, really good players, you know, you hear the few, one or two notes, you understand who it is just by the sound, let alone, you know, the musical ideas or the way things are being played.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you are by far one of the most soulful mandolin players. I can't help but think that all that stuff between your family's singing background and the Dave Terrace period, like, I think it all must add up and get distilled into your mandolin playing, too.
Of course, of course. You know, my, you know, I'm one person, so the, you know, so whether I play, you know, a clarinet or, you know, or a mandolin, it all, you know, it's all there, and they're all they're influencing one another, and in terms of stylistic things as well, it's all sort of there.
Yeah. What, go back a little bit, there's that sort of amazing famous photo of you alongside Bill Monroe that's actually in the liner notes of the CD. Where paint the picture of what that day was like.
Okay, I mean, that was, as we were putting, I didn't even know that picture existed.
Okay.
And at the exact time we were putting together the jacket for the record, that picture surfaced. A friend of mine, Marty Cutler saw it. I guess Fred Robbins, who's a, you know, wonderful person, a photographer, and he took a bunch of pictures of that festival, and he posted them, and Marty Cutler saw it, and he said, you know, that's Andy, and he sent it to my friend Mark Horowitz, who sent it to me, and I said, yes, yeah, that's me. So we didn't even know that existed.
Wow.
It surfaced at the exact right time, you know, and particularly, you know, with his name Robus and with the dream that I had and everything, it's just sort of a wild thing. So that was there. So I was really excited. Back then, it was 1966, I believe. I was like the second Roanoke/Fincastle Bluegrass Festival. And, you know, pretty much everybody was there in bluegrass, more or less. And what was most exciting to me was that there were going to be these, you know, reunions of great bands that Monroe had with past players. I remember Rudy Lyle was there, you know, and, you know, Sonny Osborne and Mac Wiseman. And there's a band they put together with Don Reno, you know, Bill Monroe with Don Reno, Mac Wiseman,
wow,
and Benny Martin. I mean, you know, these,
yeah,
guys were, you know, at the height of their powers back then. I mean, was, you know, and clearly enjoying being together, or Bill Monroe and Jimmy Martin, and yeah, I mean, it was a pretty amazing thing. So I was, I'd gotten into bluegrass when I was about 11, 12 years old, and I'd start out with guitar and then banjo, and so I've been playing mandolin for about a year, a little over a year, when, you know, when I was, I switched to mandolin around when I was around almost 15. So that's I've been playing for about a year then, and I was just, you know, all these guys were like, they're my heroes, you know. And in that picture, I was probably freaked out to be so close to Bill Monroe and trying to very stealthily have a bat notice me walk away, you know. I mean, back then, if one of these guys saw me with a mandolin case, I'd be very, you know, very embarrassed, you know, like, who am I to be, you know, be holding a mandolin next to these giants?
Wow.
And, yeah, it was just incredible. It was really, really, it was a really wonderful experience. I mean, you know, I learned so much. You know, there were about 300 people there. Everybody there was a musician or an aficionado, you know, and it was just incredible. It was really, really incredible.
How much longer did it take for you to muster up the courage to actually approach Bill?
I met Bill at at one of Tex Logan's picking parties and barbecues in the summer. It might have been that, could have been actually earlier that, yeah, it probably had to have been earlier that summer. And I was just so, you know, just so nervous, and, you know, and he was very, very nice to me, very kind to me, and you know, I didn't even want to play, but I was sort of forced to play. So, you know, yeah, he was great. He was really, really wonderful.
How was he as a mentor in terms of actually walking you through stuff when you asked?
No, I didn't study with Bill Monroe. I just had a very you know, casual relationship with
okay.
him when I met him, and I didn't really know him all that well. But who I did study was with David Grisman.
Sure.
And,
who was how much older could he have been from you? He's not.
David is about maybe 5 years older
okay.
than me.
So,
like that for
yeah,
seven,
okay.
So when I went to see him, it was the beginning of, it was a year earlier possibly. And I'd just gotten, sort of a semi-round back mandolin, you know, and I'd been playing guitar and banjo before that, you know, going down to Washington Square and playing in bands and stuff. And the mandolin just, the sound of it just really sent me, so to speak. So he really gave me whole lessons, you know, not just organically on aesthetics, and, you know, you got to listen to Bill Monroe, and, you know, I forgot what he showed me. He might have showed me Pike County Breakdown, the way Monroe plays it then. And he told me to bring a reel-to-reel tape recorder, because he had an archive of, you know, hundreds of live tapes and, you know, tapes of 78s and 45s, you know, which you just couldn't get, you know, back then. And he said, why don't you record this and this and this, and, you know, lock the door when you leave, and, you know, give me a call when you need another lesson. So I was there for about another 2-3 hours recording stuff. So, you know, you had to leave early on. And I tried to figure out what I could. You know, I played hooky for school, basically, and I spent, you know, I don't know, 10, 12 hours a day trying to learn solos note for note. And, you know, at first it took a long time, and eventually got to the point where I could hear a solo and know what key was in by the way the person was playing. But so I would learn, you know, didn't road do 5 tremolo strokes or 7 tremolo strokes, because I really felt it really made a difference in the expressiveness of what he was going for. You know, it was a spontaneous thing, but it wasn't a random thing. It had to do with his intent on expressing a musical idea and getting the feeling that he wanted out of it. It would be almost as like how long a singer will hold a note, or someone, you know, on a legato instrument will hold a note. So, you know, I got into it very microscopically. And, you know, after about, I don't know, 2 months, I called up David and said, come on down. And I came down, and he, you know, I had a few questions. How do you do this? And I was also working on, you know, Jesse McReynolds and Bobby Osborne at the same time as well. and he said, you know, and Frank Wakefield, and he said, well, if you do this like this, you know, do this like this, is this how you you would play this passage? So I say, oh, if you play that passage like that, that means you could do this like this and this like this. In other words, the mandolin is very logical. So one question that was answered answered a whole bunch of other questions. And he said, you know, after a lesson, you know, the lesson, he said, okay, listen, you know, I got to go. Why don't you record this other stuff? So in the course of about 2 years, I took about, I don't know, 5-6 lessons, you know, from him, you know, in that style. And it really sort of gave me the keys to the highway. I understood how to transcribe solos. I understood how to go about learning a musical language. I understood, you know, how important tone production was and how to go about getting it. You know, I began to understand, you know, how to play a melody, ornamentation, how to improvise, you know, just a whole bunch of different skills. And he also, he'd got me interested in listening to people like, you know, Eddie Lang and Joe Venuti and Django Reinhardt, you know, and Stephan Grappelli, and then sure. other types of jazz. And, you know, so things sort of moved on from that. But Dave was sort of my really, I'd studied, you know, banjo with a number of great players, but Dave was really my primary teacher in terms of giving me a real sure footing in how to be a musician. And certainly in understanding, you know, having a sense of aesthetics and appreciating people like Blumen and other people. So, when I was down there at that festival, I already had drunk from that well a lot, and was you know, pretty aware of what was going on, and you know, it was just a real joy for me to be down there, you know, playing music out in the fields with different people. I remember, you know, Big Joe Green was out there playing. You know, I played with him at a bunch of. It was just an amazing, amazing scene. Jimmy Martin would be singing out in the fields. It was really a great, 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 wonderful, affirming experience. And everyone were there, who was there was just completely elated. Everyone left there with a, you know, so inspired and so high from the music and the. I guess the communal experience of love for this music and, you know, admiration for, you know, all these great musicians. And all the musicians were really just sort of very generous and kind and very open. And it was really, really an amazing thing.
Yeah. What did your family think of you diving into bluegrass as much as deep as you did?
Well, you know, on my mother's side in particular, you know, my father was musical, but on my mother's side, you know, we came from a musical family of like religious singers and composers, Kansas going back, you know, to the, you know, early 1700s. And when they came to America, you know, they went into, some were classical musicians, some became leaders of, you know, Broadway pit bands, you know, others went into, like vaudeville and, you know, sort of acting, and one of my cousins was, I think he had the first one-man show on Broadway, his name was Willie Howard. He did a lot of what they used to call shorts, you know, back in the, you know, 30s and 40s. And then there was a one named Sammy Fain, who was part of Tin Pan Alley, and when they started having music in on movies, after the jazz singer, they brought him out to Hollywood, and he wrote for the movie. So he wrote songs like Love is a Many Splendid Thing, I'll Be Seeing You,
wow.
April Love. He wrote the music for Alice in Wonderland.
Wow.
I used to visit him when I used to play out in L.A., you know, when he was still alive. And, you know, he had 3 or 4 Oscars on his piano. And he would tell me stories. He would take me out to the Brown Derby, if you know what that was.
Yeah, of course.
You know, to eat. And, you know, so there was this whole musical thing happening in the family. So, you know, my parents just wanted me to, I guess, you know, be a little bit more attentive to my schoolwork. And, you know, they're always worried about, you know, can you make a living doing this? So it was, you know, and also, I mean, it was, you know, here I was 15 years old, and, you know, I was going out to, like, they let me into bars to see Red Allen or Don Reno, you know, in sort of rural New Jersey and stuff like that. And I'd be getting home at 2 a.m. It was you know, an understandably difficult period for them. And, you know, but, thank God it all worked out. And, you know, they understood. They were just nervous about whether or not I'd be able to make a living doing it. And, you know, I was playing in a band in the late 60s. I was playing saxophone in a band then. And we got there was a review in the New York Times, and I got a really good review from it. And after that, it dawned on me that maybe I can make a living doing it. So things cooled out, you know, a bunch. But, yeah, it was rough for them. I mean, I feel bad about it, but I was just sort of, I was driven. I was a zealot in terms of bluegrass at that point, you know, and that got me into jazz and, you know, different types of ethnic music and other things. But back then I was just, that's all I wanted to do, was just play bluegrass. And I had, you know, I wanted to get good enough so I could maybe go down to Nashville and try and play, you know, with one of the bands. I began, you know, hanging out with the musicians and knowing the different musicians, and it was really an amazing, amazing experience.
Yeah. Did you ever make that Nashville trip?
No, I didn't. I basically wound up getting into jazz and playing saxophone, you know, which led to me playing clarinet. But I moved away from bluegrass for many, many years.
Yeah.
So, or at least playing it so much, you know.
You're such a researcher and searcher. You found, obviously, that Dave Terrace, you've told that story to us before. You've told that story a lot. Were there other musicians, maybe not as well known, that you found sort of leading and, you know, past their prime, but who you were able to learn from in any aspect of music?
Yeah. I mean, I was into, you know, Dave Karras came as a result of my being into jazz, basically. But that's you know, so that was a little bit later on. But, yeah, I mean, I studied with a wonderful, a genius, Iperet, as part of northern Greece, the Albanian border, a clarinetist named Pericles Halkias, who was pretty old. He didn't speak, the only English he spoke was numero uno. That's the only thing he could say in English. And the lesson was basically buying a small bottle of Seagram's, or else a small bottle of, it was like Ouzo 12, or I forgot what it was, you know, and maybe $5. That was just nothing. And then I'd spend hours with him, and he would just play for me and show me, you know, something. And he had, you know, they had no real way of teaching. And so that's when, you know, I studied with, I used to play the Azerbaijani tar. I studied Azerbaijani classical music with two great musicians, one named Zvulun of Shalimov, who was just a soulful playwright, his own style, and the other one I studied was a guy named Andranik Arustamian. And
Armenian?
He was Armenian, yeah. But he was born in Georgia, but all these guys wound up in Azerbaijan, and then they wound up in Azerbaijani music and Persian music is somewhat close, so they wound up, you know, in Persia as well. And Zvulun, I think, was from Dagestan, I believe. But they played Azerbaijani classical music. And, so Andranik was one of the most, he had the most amazing left hand I had ever seen on almost anyone, you know. He had such an understanding of, you know, he's playing a spike fiddle. He had such an amazing understanding of the fingerboard. You know, he could play Mozart and Bach, but he was schooled in the traditional, what they call maqam, you know, the classical music and the development of the scale. And so I learned a lot just from, you know, being with him. You know, and he wouldn't let me tape anything. Mostly the teachers let me tape something. I had to memorize this stuff, you know, and like an hour of subway ride back to where I was living then. So, you know, and I had the good fortune to, I studied Siri with Adolf Sandoli, who's, had a brother in Philly. They were the Sandoli brothers. and Coltrane studied with Adolf's brother. I forgot his first name. And in more recent years, I studied with a guy named Cal Opperman, who was just an amazing sort of Renaissance man on the clarinet. He studied clarinet playing with sort of the great classical clarinet players, you know, who came up in the late 19th, early 20th century. And he inherited that as a clarinetist, but he also studied reed making and clarinet repairing.
Wow.
with the European masters who were in New York City at that time. And Richard Stoltzman used to live at his house. You know, Stoltzman was one of probably his most famous students. So, I went to him to make a barrel for me for the clarinet, and we just wound up really hitting it off, and became pretty close. And he would, give me lessons and stuff. Because I never really, when I studied with Dave or with Pericles, they had no real way of teaching. I never had a formal teacher who was coming from a classical background. So he knew I wasn't, he knew what I was going for, and he was able to show me a bunch of things that would really enhance my playing, technically and tone-wise. And, he was just an amazing, amazing musician, great composer. He, wrote probably some of, the most amazing etudes for clarinet, and great educator.
Yeah.
He was just an all-around amazing person. He used to be a boxer. He played in World War II. He played in one of the bands that for Patton. And I asked him about Patton. He said Patton came in and said, "Okay, he brought a bunch of booze and gave everyone drinks. And he was very nice to everyone. And he was a big fan of Patton. So But I worked very closely. I actually produced his last records with one of the great sort of Hasidic composers and singers, someone named Benzion Shanker, who basically a storehouse for a vast treasure of thousands of Hasidic, very complicated melodies. Of the group that he belonged to, as well as writing hundreds of his own melodies that are just incredible. And there's also there was someone named the Boston Rebbe, who I was also close with, who also wrote about 4,000 compositions. And I've been very privileged to be around, really, really great musicians, particularly, older ones. What I found is that I realized early on, back when I was in my 20s, that musicians are just constantly getting better. And with these older musicians, while they may not have be as on top of their chops, or some of them did have their chops, but others maybe not. But their understanding of music and how to express it is just continually growing. And the older they get, the better they get. And, their understanding of how to bring out the feeling in melodies, or how to interpret melodies, how to improvise, how to compose, it just gets better and better and better. It gets more and more refined, regardless of the age. So, unless there's some sort of catastrophic thing happens to them, So, but all these people were just getting better and better and writing better and better stuff and applying just more and more expressively. I know for Dave, I had the honor of producing his last record. I mean, he still had chops. He could have done things, but he would do just glisses or slurs or certain things instead of playing a notey passage, although he would sometimes choose to do that as well. But he didn't need to do it. His playing was just so expressive, his tone and his use of notes. And, getting back to the mandolin, you have that certainly in Bill Monroe as well. He was still writing great tunes and really playing wonderful things on the mandolin. Bobby Osborne is really great. I mean, he's still... you know, I was I did a gig that he was playing on. He was playing triple stops and all sorts of stuff. And he's in certain ways he's better than ever. You know,
sure.
He's you know creatively and in terms of his understanding of music and what to do and what not to do. And you know, it's I think musicians just. And even if you don't play, but you sort of stay with it, then you pick it up again. It'll take a few months to get your chops back, but musically, you'll find that you know you'll be really, you know, you're in another place. You know, you've lived that much longer, and consciously or unconsciously, the music is going on inside of you, and it's just developing. So, you know, that's yes. I've been very lucky to spend a lot of time with these people.
Yeah,
I'm very blessed.
I gotta ask, your musical journey is one of the most fascinating to me, and I love every facet of it. What are you listening to right now? What's on your stereo?
Well, let's see. You know, let's see. What do I have? I mean, I listen to a lot of different. You know, I mean, I listen to a lot of stuff. I go through different. Different things. You know, I've been listening to a lot of Coleman Hawkins lately, actually, and, you know, a bunch of Wanda Jackson. It's a wide array of music. There was a compilation of 78s by a great Greek clarinetist, you know, mainland from Athens clarinetist named Karakoski, who recorded these things in the, you know, the late 20s, early 30s, 40s. I always love that style of clarinet playing. Really, really expressive. Very, very beautiful. You know, some Bill Monroe. And, you know, the Osborne Brothers. I mean, I just listen to a lot of stuff. I've been listening to some Ecuadorian music recently. You know, some of the great guitarists from down there. And I just listen to lots of different things. And everything I hear, I want to learn, which is, of course, impossible. But, you know, I'm listening to all these different things, and some of them I do get around to learning or trying to learn.
It's amazing. I mean, I found, you know, my journey was I was a kid in the, you know, 90s, found punk rock and then free jazz and sort of found my way into klezmer through Ben Goldberg and the new Klezmer Trio and some of the more wild
right.
stuff. And then sort of worked my way back to the folk idiom and then found myself listening to bluegrass. I mean, it's everybody's journey is so different. It's amazing.
Interestingly, it was through jazz. You know, I was listening to jazz, but when I heard Albert Eiler, that made me decide I wanted to play just like that, you know.
Yeah.
And that and getting into Albert Eiler and Coltrane and all that stuff is what got me into world music, which has got me into klezmer music. I remember thinking back when I was listening, you know, to Albert Eiler a lot, you know, I heard these certain, you know, klezmer tunes, you know, as a kid. And I said, you know, these are not so unlike what he was doing in that particular period of time. It was like the Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village where he had the violin and the...
Yeah.
He was playing sort of like folk Balkan type tunes or Salvation
sure.
Army type tunes and then went into free, quote unquote, free improvisation, you know. And so I figured some of these klezmer tunes would be great to play that way and then just, you know, so I had I did the same thing as you did. So, you know, going from, you know, sort of more jazz approach and into the more traditional music.
Yeah. What? Tell me a little bit about the making of this record, the Monroe record. What? Where was it recorded? Have you played with all these people before? What was the backstory there?
Yeah, I originally thought it was going to be a record of Monroe tunes, and I wound up writing all these tunes. You know, some of which are sort of extensions of some of his tunes. Some of which are, you know. You know, don't really. You may not see a connection, but it's still sort of there in my mandolin playing. But so I've been working with Larry Eagle and Jim Whitney, you know, the bass player and drum player we're one of the oldest working bands around. Meaning, you know, I mean we all will do freelance stuff, but it's you know, we've been playing steadily for about the last almost 20 years. So, you know, we have this just incredible communicative thing happening. So, you know, when we play a tune, we have no real arrangements. We just sort of, you know, through eye contact or gesture or whatever, we just, you know, we all know what to do and how to do it. And, you know, it's an amazing thing having, you know, a band like that for so long. It's really, really wonderful. And we had the previous record we had done with Michael Cleveland, and you know, I thought he'd be a natural for this. So we are recording a place called Acoustic Sound in Brooklyn here, and we brought Michael in for the basics, and we probably recorded, I don't know, 23, 24 songs. And you know, when the record was finally mixed, we just picked 12. I guess for this, it would make sense for this record, and the others will be released, you know, maybe the next or, you know, somewhere down the road. So Michael is just Michael can really pretty much play anything he really wants to, and he's really just a wonderful person and a fantastic musician, inspiring to work with, and he really knows just sort of what to do. So those are the basic tracks, and then we brought in this really amazing keyboard player named Glenn Patcha, who you know, can play a number of different root styles, as well as you know, is a good jazz player as well. So you know, we had a Hammond B3 in the, as well as a piano there, and he also had a pump organ. So we used him. We brought in you know, Michael Davis for a few tunes, and a friend of mine who plays Azerbaijani music to play drums and kamancha on one tune, and a cornet player to play on a few tunes. I used to like to do records pretty much live, and I began to see in the last, you know, two records or so, the advantage of Pro Tools, that what it affords you as a composer. So I was able to hear the tunes over a period of time and decide that I wanted to add sections or delete sections or change sections around or add this thing or that thing. And it's as a compositional tool, it's absolutely fantastic. I just love it. You know, and I, years ago, it would have gone against my whole aesthetic of doing everything live. But I, as a composer, I see the real, advantages of having such a tool at your disposal. So some of the tunes, you know, like some of the duets with the keyboard, I mean, that stuff is live. But other things, you know, I added sections, deleted sections, changed things around. It affords you the ability to put a bunch of disparate things together. I know. Glenn was playing the organ on one song, and it was like sort of like a sound like a, you know, a Sunday, you know, jazz brunch in Newark, New Jersey, or something like that. You know, the type of bluesy playing, the bluesy style stuff he was playing, and you know, it was just, you know, he was just getting warmed up just for a completely other song. I remember it, and I said this would be a great intro for this song. So we just, you know, we moved things around, and so that's in a nut. That's not such a nutshell, but that's basically the way, you know, that this was, you know, recorded and produced. You know, with the basic tracks and then overdubs. You know, and, you know, bring people in and you know, for the overdubs and things, and then fooling around with the mixing with form. It's really just a wonderful thing to do.
What Kimball mandolin throughout the whole thing?
Yeah. It's a great mandolin, yeah.
And just give me the rundown again. I know you've talked to me about this, but tell me about this, what that mandolin is.
It's about a 3-year old. Let me see what years it's built. Does he have the? I don't even think he has the year in this. It's from July 2014. So it's older than that. He, you know, I'd been going, you know, I'd played an other F5, and then I sort of traded him for a 2 points, and then I traded him for this. And it's just a great mandolin. It records really well. You know, I use one of those reconstituted tortoiseshell picks, and so, you know, I like a slightly brighter sound, and not much else I can say.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it records very well. I'm very pleased.
Do you mic it differently than you did your A5, the Snakehead?
When I record, there's two problems. One problem is that I get into the music, so even live gigs, I move around, so that's a problem with the miking right there, particularly for recording. And so there's that, but a larger problem, or may or may not be a problem, is that I hum along when I you know, sometimes quite loudly when I play. So the engineer, who's the producer, or the assistant engineer, he's an engineer, but he's the assistant engineer on this, he was able to set up two microphones so that it would sort of somehow cancel out a lot of the loud humming that I can do sometimes, you know. I remember one time when I recorded with Vassar. It was back in like 1966 or something like that, and we're listening, and we said, "What's that? What's that?" And I said, "Oh, that's just me singing along." Like, you know, he was cool with it; just wondered what it was. So it's, you know, it's there. So sometimes louder, sometimes not. I don't really mind it. But so he had a particular way of miking it so it would cancel out a bunch of that stuff. So he would use two different Shep mics on. Chefs, I guess they're called, you know, mics to record me.
that seems to, from what you just said, that predates you kind of the horn and the jazz stuff, right? You've been humming while you play the whole time.
I think I do, and even when I play a wind instrument, I'm sort of humming along as well. You just can't hear it.
Wow!
But it's just, you know, and. I'm not sure what I'm humming, but some people tell me that I'm basically humming either the melody, you know, even though I'm improvising, or what I'm improvising, I'm humming. It's really an unconscious thing to me. It's just, you know, and since I've seen people, I know like Glenn Gould was a very big hummer, and they used to have to record him sometimes with a gas mask on or something like that. And certainly, you know, like Keith Jarrett or, you know, and Oscar Peterson are huge hummers as well. So I see it's while it's not common, it's not so uncommon, you know. So you know, it's that you know, just sort of unfortunately comes, or fortunately comes with the territory. I just always have done it. I guess it's just, you know, having to do with concentration and the you know, I don't know.
No, it's, you're in good company.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not to compare myself with them, but yeah, you know. So that's why he would record. I remember once the humming was so loud that it was really disconcerting. So I just relearned my improvisation and re-recorded it.
Oh wow!
And I was conscious not to hum. So. But, you know, live, like in this, you know, in a gig or in the studio, it's, you know, it's just going to be there because I'm really concentrating, and I guess it's sort of an unconscious manifestation of my concentration.
It's great. It's amazing. You said, you know, the spirit of Monroe lives throughout these songs. What do you think, the song that really slays me is that last one, Burger and Fries. What do you think Bill would think of that song? The organ and everything.
He recorded with organ. I don't know if that was his choice, but he didn't veto it. You know, on a gospel song or two. It's hard to know what he really thought about certain things because he was very understandably protective of his music and his. I don't think there'd be any reason why he wouldn't like it. You know,
it's a great song.
Yeah. thank you. Yeah, it was sort of reflecting, you know, when I was you know, like 7, 8 years old, I went to a day camp, and we used to go to a pool, you know, a public pool, and swim. And they had, you know, a place there where, you know, all the guys with the big, you know, greased back pompadours and, you know, and the girls in bikinis would hang out, and there'd be burgers and fries and Coke and, you know, and the jukebox would be blasting. And I just remember, you know, I grew up with all that, you know, all that stuff. I was younger, you know, but I remember what, you know, it was probably about 4 or 5 when rock and roll started really hitting, but I remember that whole culture pretty well, and so it's sort of an ode to that. The song was originally written to be a little bit of a feel of an Everly Brothers song, and we moved it to a slightly different place, you know.
You got a little funky, yeah.
A little bit different. So, in fact, we had 2 possible takes we were going to use, and, you know, I there was a slightly brighter tempo with a slightly more, it's just too commercial for me. So I went for a slightly darker sound with, you know, the windows a little bit darker and had a little bit more, not as slick and had a little bit more feeling to it, you know, and I, you know, that's when we sort of rewrote the intro and, you know, it's, you know, moved it into a sort of a whole other direction a little bit, you know, more bluesy and sort of more R&B-ish than it was originally envisioned to. I just sort of went with the track.
You think like I do, even though we're doing very niche-y things, it's like, no, that's too mainstream. That's too pop-based.
No, listen, you know, it's by commercial, I mean, that's just not, that,
it lacks some,
you know,
soul.
Commercial is great also. No, that doesn't lack soul. It's just not, that's not really what I'm generally into express. You know, I'm into, it's just a different style. I mean, I can do that at, you know, I can do a more commercial thing, you know, so to speak, if, you know, if I was called to do it, but that's not really where my head was at for this particular record. You know, I like things to be a little more grittier and a bit rougher than a really finely polished finished thing in general. Although you can have something that's gritty and polished as well, but it, you know, it's hard to sort of describe in words, but it just sounded too much like a country, you know, like a sort of you know, one of 100, you know, country instrumentals, you know,
sure.
And it didn't have anything individual, you know, they all have great playing, they're all really done well, but it didn't have anything that was really distinctive or unique about it or really compelling, so to speak. I thought, you know, it's just it's a good melody, but so when we had the slightly darker cut, I said, yeah, this is as good as the other one sounds. This is really something that I can, you know, I could relate to that feel, you know, a bluesier feel, you know, sort of reinterpreted the song. I sort of like that better. I hadn't been thinking about that initially, but I mean, that happens every time you play music anyway, particularly if you improvise a lot and stuff. It's just, you know, the music goes to a whole other place. You just have to sort of be open to it. So. You know,
it's music.
Yeah, that's music, and you want it to be expressive, and I felt that this would be a more expressive vehicle for me, and for where the tune was, you know, the slower tempo brought out sort of things in the tune that I hadn't really saw were there, and allowed me to really be able to do a whole bunch of stuff on it that I wouldn't. That wouldn't may not have been fitting, let's put it that way, for the slightly brighter version. And but like you say, that's music, you know, and you really need to be sort of in the moment and open to you know, what's going on. But the truth is that, you know, everyone, you know, usually there's at least 2 cuts, you know, maybe sometimes more in the studio, and you have to make a decision on which one has the best feel, you know, which one is, you know, the one you want to work with. And, you know, there are always surprises in that. So. Yeah.
You're such a treasure in New York City. Are you going on the road anytime soon?
Probably in the fall and in the winter. Right now, I'll pretty much be in the New York City area.
Okay. And any thoughts on future recording? Are you and Grisman ever going to get back together on due recording?
You know, maybe at some time. You know, I might be out in your neck of the woods sometime in February.
Okay.
And if I have time, you know, he always wants to record stuff, so I would maybe head over to his house and spend some time with him. We haven't spent, you know, occasionally in New York or on, you know, and, you know, I spend an afternoon with him where I know. The last I really spoke with him, we both happened to be in L.A. at the same time. Ah. And, so we're in contact there. We didn't have a chance to get together, but... yeah, down the line, I'm sure there'll be some other things that'll be happening.
Great.
You know, the record business is so crazy now. The CD business or the, I don't know, what do you want to call it, the streaming business, I guess. It's, you know, new cars don't have CD players anymore.
Yeah.
It's back almost to the age of the Edison cylinder or one-sided CD or just streaming. You know, and you know, I wonder particularly like with streaming whether it can further depersonalize who's playing the music. You know, like in other words, if you had a CD or something, whatever, there might be liner notes or something. You'll see who's playing on the session, maybe learn something about it, who wrote the tune. And with records in particular, you know, you'd have to get up and take some physical effort, you know, to get up and turn the record over or replay a track that you wanted to hear. But with streaming, it's sort of effortless, and it can become just sort of almost like music, background music, you know. You know, I don't know what the effect will be or what the effect is, you know, so, but I wonder whether it in certain ways depersonalizes music in a certain way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I understand completely. It's becoming more passive. It used to be an event to go buy a record and then to put the record on, and now it's just, it could be a podcast, it could be music, it could be the hum of the engine or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I remember when I was getting bluegrass records when I was in my early teens. I would have to travel an hour and a half to the record store, an hour and a half back, you know, to you know, I'd spend hours in the record store seeing what was there and trying to, you know, decide which one I could afford. And I was always listening to music that I didn't understand to try and grasp what was going on with it until I sort of understood it. And in fact, I've had students, mandolin students, who were not that into Bill Monroe. You know, they just didn't know.
Is that because they're into like Chris Thiele and don't get their history, or they just didn't like?
Yeah, Bill Monroe? Well, that's part of it. I mean, you know, music changes, and I see that in many cases. Past history becomes really disposable. So, I know, like, for a number of people I spoke to who I thought were knowledgeable in bluegrass, thought the Kenny Baker plays Bill Monroe was the first recorded versions of a lot of those tunes. and when I told them no, they recorded, you know, years earlier, they said, what do you mean? What do you mean they recorded? You know, they were like slightly challenging me and you know, so it's, you know, it's interesting. Like, I think in 1950, and this is sort of late, I guess towards the end of his career, Al Jolson was probably the best well-known male in the world in 1950. I think Life magazine or something like that did a thing, and you know, now almost no one knows Al Jolson.
Sure.
I was giving a class, and actually in the University of Washington there in Seattle in the ethnomusicology department, and I was saying, you know, if you play the music this way, it'll sound like the theme song for Laurel and Hardy, and I got old blank books, and no one knew who Laurel and Hardy were. You know, now I guess there was a recent movie, you know, celebrating
their
lives.
Yeah, it's kind of a flop, but yeah.
It was a flop, but I'm saying, but no one knew who these people were, you know, and, when I grew up, I mean, the way the culture was, you know, you had like almost the past 100 years of history, like living around you, you know, alive,
yeah.
You know, that just sort of over the years, you know, changed. And now it's, in bluegrass, I mean, there's a whole thing of people going back to Bill Monroe, you know, younger people and wanting to sound like that and try and, you know, playing that aesthetic. So you have that, and you have, like, you know, the people who play what they call early jazz and thing. You know, so you have, you know, groups of people who are really into it. But in the general culture, you know, unless you're like a real musical, aficionado.
Sure.
You're just going to, you know, it just sort of, I've heard of Bill Monroe, yeah. I mean, I had to tell my students, I would say to them, listen, you know, you just listen to it until you get it, you know, because they heard a little Monroe, they didn't like it. I said, yeah, it's a real, you know, it's a real ethnic sound. I said, just listen to it until you get it, and then you'll understand what's going on, and it'll be great for you. But you know, you're not gonna hear it right away. But you know, I understand how you're reacting to it, and it's almost like a bit of a you know, musical amnesia to some degree. But I mean, you know.
Yeah. Final question. I'm only asking this because Eastman just lent me one of their new ones. Have you played the electric mandolin ever?
Not really. I had an old four-string mandolin, like an old Fender, and I just, you know, I never really experimented with it. To me, it sounded sort of like a somewhere between an electric piano and a pedal steel or something like that, and it you know, a little bit like of a guitar. So I've never really had a good one that I played.
All right, I was just curious. I'd be curious to see where you would take it if you embraced it. So
they make nice. They're good. You know,
they just sent me one that's, I think it's the EM5 or something, and it's a good sounding. I mean, I haven't really put it through its paces, but I plugged it in and it sounded like a mandolin, and it's, I don't know, $1,100 or something. I don't know. I could send you a link to it if you wanted, but yeah.
Yeah, how many strings does it
it's
have?
It's got the full strings. It's got eight.
Eight strings, wow.
Yeah, so.
But something to think about. I don't, you know, I didn't know that Eastman made.
I think it's just coming out. I think maybe they had it at that NAMM show or something. But it's pretty cool.
I heard that they just came out with relatively recently with these A model sound mandolins, both oval hole and F hole. I know someone who bought an oval hole one, like, mm-hmm. under $1,000. He says it's one of the best mandolins he's ever had, and he's had lots of F5s, and he liked it so much he ordered an F hole one.
Wow, yeah, I mean, they're doing great stuff. This one's called the ERM, and it's on their website. Its list price is $1,200, but I love it. I mean, I've only played it since the 3 days ago since they sent it, but yeah, interesting.
Do you use it through like a regular amp? Or?
Yeah, I just plugged it into a Fender Champ. So,
you know, I've thought over the years, you know, I work with drums, but I love, you know, just working the mic. But it's something to think about. I mean, if I found, you know,
I take the humming out of the equation,
that's for sure. And also I wouldn't have to worry about being on mic as well.
Yeah,
so system. And what I do for live gigs is you know, I have mics that I carry with me that I plug into the I plug into a Fishman amp, and then the house takes a feed from the back of the amp. So I use it sort of as a monitor and sort of tone control thing.
Got it.
So you know.
Yeah, maybe look it up. You know, ERM.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up. Thanks. Thanks for telling me. Thanks,
yeah, sure.
You know, listen, it's great to talk to you, and thanks for, you know, writing about this.
Oh, of course.
I really appreciate it.
Sorry we were late to the game, but better late than never. So, yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
I'm glad you enjoy the record.
Oh, it's great.
Okay, thanks
so much. Good talking
to
you, Andy. Thanks.